Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm Patrick Castillo, Artistic Administrator of Music at Menlo. This festival season, which we have entitled Through Brahms, explores the music of one of the 19th century's most imposing geniuses. Johannes Brahms lived from 1833 to 1897, at the height of the Romantic period, and had an immense impact on the music of the 19th century, leaving behind one of the most important bodies of work in the Western canon. While unquestionably accomplished as a composer of orchestral music, Brahms especially thrived in writing for small forces. Following the death of his mentor Robert Schumann in 1856, Brahms emerged as chamber music's most significant voice. His chamber works, which span the whole of his artistic maturity, reflect the essence of his creativity and are widely regarded as the finest contribution to the chamber music literature since Beethoven. As part of this summer's exploration of the music of Brahms, Music at Menlo is excited to welcome back the Orion String Quartet in a special two-concert series, Brahms, the Quartets in Context. Brahms left behind only three string quartets, though he is known to have completed and discarded about 20 more. An uncompromising perfectionist, Brahms notoriously burned sheaves of manuscripts of pieces with which he was not completely satisfied. The three quartets that survive are the Quartet in C minor, Opus 51, No. 1, and the Quartet in A minor, Opus 51, No. 2, completed in 1873, and the Quartet in B flat major, Opus 67, completed in 1876. Though meager in number, the Brahms quartets are immensely rich in content and represent an essential component of the Romantic quartet literature. The Orion String Quartet will present the three Brahms quartets, juxtaposed with music by Brahms's forebears and artistic descendants. The first of the two programs, on August 4, complements the Opus 51 quartets with the String Quartet No. 4 of the American composer Leon Kirchner. Kirchner lived from 1919 to 2009. He was a student of Arnold Schoenberg and in many ways a torchbearer of the Viennese tradition that traces back to Beethoven and Brahms. The Orion Quartet's second program prefaces Brahms's Opus 67 quartet with the string quartet in C-sharp minor Opus 131 of Ludwig van Beethoven, the composer whose footsteps Brahms heard behind him throughout his creative life, as well as the enigmatic Five Movements for String Quartet Opus 5 of Anton Webern, another student of Schoenberg and a more immediate artistic heir to the Brahmsian tradition. Earlier this season, I had an opportunity to discuss these programs with Orion String Quartet violinist Daniel Phillips.
Brahms, in general, was—he felt like in the footsteps or the shadows of Beethoven. So I guess he felt a lot of pressure to come up to that kind of level. So therefore, he threw out a lot of his pieces. I don't remember the number of quartets, but there were a lot of quartets, and he only thought three of them were okay. So that's what we have left. But in that way, since they were like what he thought the best of them, they have like the kind of substance and depth and brilliance of composition that we would come that Brahms himself came to expect of himself. So therefore, they're solid standards in the quartet repertoire.
Speaking of Beethoven, can you point to anything in Brahms's quartets that demonstrate that influence?
Well, in Brahms's day, Brahms's considered to be old-fashioned and a sort of a classical composer in the face of the more new romantic wave, you know, like Wagner and then Richard Strauss soon after that, even though we think of Brahms as being the epitome of romanticism. But he's a classicist in the same way Beethoven is, where he takes a very small amount of motivic material, little cells or little recognizable bits, and makes a big construction out of it, which is what Beethoven is so great for. Think of the Fifth Symphony. Da, 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 da. The entire movement is just filled with that little cell, and a huge construction is made out of it. So we have, you know, like a 10 or 15 minute piece made out of a 5-second cell. Mm-hmm. So Brahms follows that pattern with a few of his own personal twists, but pretty much he follows the classical pattern. And the slow movements are beautiful singing things, much like Beethoven's slow movements are. He often puts a minuet and trio or similar event, and the Stiemann variations and the B-flat quartet. And the finales are also have a similar classical structure too. So in that way, he really is a classicist. And whenever you study the music, it studies like classical music.
And what distinguishes it? Where do these cornets depart from Beethoven?
Yeah. Well, my really smart colleagues at Queen's College could explain it better. But so the harmonic language he goes a little bit further out than Beethoven, both in terms of chromaticism and the surprising harmonies and whatnot. And I guess there's a kind of an effusive expression that we kind of associate with being romantic music.
The pressure Brahms felt of living up to the legacy of Beethoven's monumental cycle of 16 string quartets might have contributed to the length of time Brahms spent agonizing over what would eventually be his first published quartet. He began work on his C minor quartet in the early 1850s. It was not until 1873 that the composer allowed it to be published as his Opus 51, number 1.
And the C minor, like Beethoven in C minor, is very terse and dramatic and a little angry sounding, but not as angry as Beethoven. But it has a similar kind of drive and intensity. And that C minor, a lot of it is hard to bring off because I think being challenged by Beethoven, he decided he needed to make it, how would we say today, like quality rich. So like each square 5 seconds of it is packed with information, like counter themes and other busy things going on. But it does have this overriding kind of drive and intensity to it, like you expect from Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, for instance, not that kind of crazy drive to it.
The first movement begins with an impassioned, ascending, dotted rhythm theme. The music quickly comes to an abrupt exclamation point, followed by a contrasting melodic idea. Less agitated than the opening, but equally intense. The violins present the urgent second theme above rapid octave leaps in the viola. The first violin rounds out the first part of the movement, the exposition, with a long-limbed melody marked piano and dolce, softly and sweetly, above a lilting accompaniment in the lower strings. The middle section of the movement, called the development, is as compact and pithy as the exposition. Like Daniel said, each measure is packed with information. Listen to how Brahms anxiously cycles through fragments of the themes he's introduced, obsessively fitting them together in different ways. The energy doesn't let up for a moment, propelling the movement through a frenzied recapitulation and coda. Thank you. The second movement, Romance, offers the listener some respite from the unrelenting Sturm und Drang of the opening Allegro. The music's expressive lyrical quality resembles the Lied ohne Worte, or Song Without Words, a romantic genre innovated by Felix Mendelssohn. But don't be fooled by the seeming disparity between this tender slow movement and the nervous energy of the first movement. One of the hallmarks of Brahms's music is his ability to generate complex structures using the simplest musical ideas. To take just one example, if you listen closely to the inner voices in the slow movement's opening measures, you might recognize this pleading half-step gesture. As a shadow of the urgent second theme in the first movement. Likewise, the ascending dotted rhythm contour of the first movement's opening theme. Is echoed throughout the romance, most clearly in the movement's closing measures. These marks of Brahms's craftsmanship reflect the influence of Beethoven, certainly, but more importantly, they give Brahms's music a feeling of organic cohesion, so that his multi-movement chamber works offer an emotional and psychological experience that is complete and viscerally compelling. In this perfect union of technique and emotional power lies the genius of Brahms. The character of the music changes again in the third movement.
Even what passes for the minuet movement or that scherzo movement ends up being a very mournful business altogether.
Both the half-step gesture and the consequential dotted rhythm of the first movement, which Brahms revisits in the Romance movement, are recalled again here as the first violin and viola offer an introspective melody in octaves. The mood brightens in the central trio section, but even here, the music's sunnier demeanor is tinged with melancholy. For the final movement, Brahms fashions a strong evocation of the opening Allegro. Both the first theme of the opening movement and its persistent second theme are reimagined in the opening measures of the finale. Thank you. The second violin introduces a new idea, marked dolce. But this music quickly escalates to a restatement of the movement's terse opening motto. After some development of these materials, the quartet ends with a gripping coda. Brahms's second string quartet, the quartet in A minor, opus 51, number 2, shares some of the gravitas of its C minor sibling.
Well, it's A minor, so like all composers, you start to attach like a certain character to a key. So A minor has a kind of essentially like a sort of mournful and serious quality throughout. A little bit turbulent, but not as terse as the C minor. But the overall character is sort of serious and mournful.
The quartet is dedicated in spirit, if not in print, to Brahms's close friend and colleague, the violinist Josef Joachim. Owing to a petty argument between the two at the time of the quartet's publication, Brahms dedicated the quartet instead to the prominent physician and amateur chamber musician Theodor Billroth. But Joachim's imprint on the quartet is deep. Not only did his quartet give the work's first performance in October 1873, Brahms moreover pays homage to Joachim in the quartet's thematic material. Joachim had adopted for himself the musical motto FAE, which stands for Frei aber einsam, free but lonely. As a tribute to his friend, Brahms begins the quartet's opening theme with this motto. Brahms lovingly marks the second theme, molto piano e sempre mezza voce, grazioso ed animato, very softly and always at half voice, graceful and lively. Author Melvin Berger writes, quote, "If it can be said that the first quartet was written under the specter of Beethoven, the spirit that informs the second belongs to Bach." End quote. Indeed, the influence of Bach's polyphonic writing, that is, the treatment of multiple independent voices, is strong throughout this opening movement. But Bach may not be the only specter haunting the A minor quartet. If you listen closely, you might hear shades of the C minor quartet as well. Consider the opening of the finale to opus 51, number 1. Might that be a distant cousin to this passage in Opus 51, number 2? Another testament to Brahms's regard for Joachim is his interweaving of Joachim's FAE motto with another three-note motif that the composer had adopted for himself, FAF, Frei aber froh, or Free but Happy. Just before the movement's animated coda, the second violin offers a sweeping line juxtaposing Brahms's FAF with Joachim's FAE. Like the slow movement of the C minor quartet, the A minor's Andante Moderato movement demonstrates the deeply felt sensibility of romantic song. Brahms labels the third movement quasi-minuetto. Its elegant triple-meter gait derives from the minuets of the classical period, but the music's moodiness is distinctly romantic. The movement's somber atmosphere is interrupted by an effervescent interlude. What happens next is a subtle but ingenious display of Brahms's craftsmanship. As a segue from this light, bubbly interlude back to the subdued quasi-minuetto music, Brahms takes the interlude melody and slows it down to the minuet tempo, ultimately returning to the opening minuet melody. The final movement betrays Brahms' lifelong passion for gypsy music. Its opening melody bursts forth with the exuberant rhythmic energy of the csárdás, a lively Hungarian folk dance. Throughout the movement, as if reconciling different dimensions of his musical identity, Brahms juxtaposes this spirited folk dance with the more genteel strains of a Viennese waltz. The discourse between those two ideas drives the A minor quartet to a stirring finish, which we won't give away here. But along the way, another striking feature of the finale is the reemergence of the FAF and FAE motifs from the first movement.
And then the B flat, the third one, it's actually its most classical feeling in a way, because it's actually the most transparent and the least busy. And B flat major is, I don't know, it's always kind of has a warm happiness to it. And it's a lighter piece altogether.
Brahms composed the Opus 67 Quartet in Heidelberg during the summer of 1875. It was an especially pleasant period for the composer. He wrote during this time, quote, "My rooms and my daily life are most agreeable. In short, life is only too gay," end quote. The gaiety of that summer saturates the opening vivace movement of what would be Brahms's final string quartet. The merry opening theme is followed by a brief introspective aside. But the music's lightheartedness immediately returns. In the development section, Brahms characteristically stretches the movement's main themes to express a broad emotional spectrum, but never with the severity of the Opus 51 quartets. Even at its most turbulent, this first movement of the Opus 67 quartet retains a sunny and extroverted demeanor.
Even the slow movement is more wistful than it is, deep and, tear-jerking. It's touching.
Despite its tempo marking of agitato, the third movement likewise emanates a subdued warmth. Brahms referred to this movement as, quote, "the tenderest and most impassioned movement I have ever written," end quote. He achieves a peculiar sonic effect by instructing the two violins and the cello to play with a mute but leaving the viola, which carries the theme at the outset, unmuted. The three muted instruments, first violin, second violin, and cello, take over at the start of the central trio section. But the viola reasserts itself with a melody audibly derived from the movement's opening. Typically, in the scherzo movement, the listener expects a degree of emotive contrast in the trio section. Here, however, Brahms chooses instead to delve more deeply into the scherzo's pensive air. The finale is a theme and variations. The theme answers the sobriety of the second and third movements with its easy, idyllic charm. A set of eight variations follows, each elaborating on the theme's essential characteristics. The finale's most delicate music comes in the sixth variation, which Brahms marks molto dolce. Set up by this music's rarefied tranquility, the seventh variation offers a wild surprise. The opening theme of the first movement has mischievously invaded the final pages of the score. And remember this brief introspective aside from early in the first movement? That music, seemingly insignificant at the time, comes back too. With its fleeting appearance in the first movement, we ultimately realize that Brahms was foreshadowing the eighth and final variation of the fourth movement. The Opus 67 Quartet, and Brahms's magnificent cycle of three string quartets, ends with a magical coda, bringing together musical ideas from the first and fourth movements. This summer's two-part concert series, Brahms' The Quartets in Context, surrounds the Brahms quartets with music by composers of future generations, Anton Webern and Leon Kirchner, and arguably the most imposing influence on Brahms' own life and career, Ludwig van Beethoven. Beethoven's string quartets serve as essential signposts throughout his artistic life. The six string quartets of his Opus 18 are a vital component of his early work. The Opus 59 Razumovsky quartets, the Opus 74 Harp quartet, and the Opus 95 Serioso quartet are likewise important products of his middle period. Near the end of his life, after completing his last symphony and his last piano sonata, Beethoven turned once again to the string quartet, as the medium for his deepest musical thoughts. The quartets to which Beethoven devoted his final years represent the pinnacle of the composer's mighty creative powers and infinite imagination. In the five late quartets that complete his incomparable cycle of 16, Beethoven surpassed all precedent for the expressive capabilities of music, as if transcending this world and composing for listeners of future generations. The impetus for Beethoven's late quartets, opuses 127, 130, 131, 132, and 135, was a commission from the Russian prince and amateur cellist Nikolai Galitzin. Galitzin asked Beethoven for, quote, one, two, or three quartets, for which labor I will be glad to pay you what you think proper, end quote. Karl Holtz, the second violinist of the Schuppanzich Quartet, who later worked as Beethoven's secretary, relates the following. Quote, during the time when he was composing the three quartets commissioned by Prince Galitzin, Opus 127, Opus 130, and Opus 132, such a wealth of new quartet ideas streamed forth from Beethoven's inexhaustible imagination that he felt almost involuntarily compelled to write the C-sharp minor and F major quartets. My dear friend, I have just had another new idea, he used to say, in a joking manner and with shining eyes when we would go out for a walk. And he wrote down some notes in a little pocket sketchbook. But that belongs to the quartet after the next one, he said, since the next one already has too many movements. When he had finished the B-flat major quartet, Opus 130, I said that I thought it the best of the three, to which he replied, each in its own way. Art demands of us that we don't stand still. You will find here a new kind of voice leading, and as to imagination, it will, God willing, be less lacking than ever before. Later he said that he thought the C-sharp minor quartet, Opus 131, his greatest. End quote. The string quartet in C-sharp minor, Opus 131, holds a special place in the hearts of many. It is unique among Beethoven's quartets in its structure, its seven movements are to be played without stopping, as well as in its powerful emotive content. Of this profound work, Richard Wagner would later remark, quote, "'Tis as if the master, grown conscious of his art, were settling to work at his magic." End quote. Thank you. countless others throughout history have shared Wagner's reverence for this iconic work. Another Holtz anecdote reports that when Franz Schubert first heard the Opus 131 quartet, quote, "he fell into such a state of excitement and enthusiasm that we were all frightened for him," end quote. In November 1828, shortly before his death, Schubert made his last musical request to hear Beethoven's Opus 131, which was played for him 5 days before he died. In Holtz's words, quote, "the King of Harmony had sent the King of Song a friendly bidding to the crossing," end quote. Music at Menlo presented Beethoven's Opus 131 String Quartet as part of our 2005 festival season, Beethoven Center of Gravity. You can listen to Festival Artistic Director David Finkel's detailed discussion of this quartet that appeared on that season's audio notes by visiting us online at www.musicatmenlo.org/multimedia/audio notes. Once again, that's www.musicatmenlo.org/multimedia/audio notes. One of the most dominant forces in Western music in the decades following Brahms's death was the Second Viennese School, a triumvirate of the post-Romantic revolutionaries Arnold Schoenberg and his students Alban Berg and Anton Webern. These three composers advanced serial and atonal music and the 12-tone method of composition that turned 20th century music on its ear. This summer's presentation of the Brahms Quartets in Context includes Webern's ephemeral 5 movements for string quartet, Opus 5. Daniel Phillips.
Well, Webern, the 5 pieces are not a 12-tone piece. So that's when both Schoenberg and Webern and Berg were just experimenting with free tonality. So the way I see it is that if you think of, like, let's go back to Mozart. Imagine, like, your favorite melody. Now, the best part is the whole melody. If that wasn't in there, the melody would be really boring, but just that one blue note or dissonant note completely makes it amazing. So I guess composers like Schoenberg said, you know what? Let's just use the good parts. The dissonance is the best part of music anyway. Let's create a whole language out of what seems beautiful, and that dissonance is beautiful, and maybe any combinations of chords can be affecting. And then, especially in that time, you know, you think that's the time of Freud and Jung digging into the unconscious and all the boogeymen in there. So a lot of that music was meant to be digging into there. So if you hear some, like, frightening or intensely disturbing sounds sometimes, they're not supposed to be relaxing. Sitting around your fireplace, whatever, and sipping your scotch. They're meant to be what they are. And so as players, we find that Weber's music is like incredibly romantic, let's say. More than Brahms, almost. And that way it kind of even goes a step further. That was their whole idea.
Yeah.
And plus, Webern's music is freeze-dried, kind of. So like it has an epic scale to the feeling to it, but it's distilled into little vignettes of like 1 or 2 minutes long. You could explode the Webern five pieces into an hour-long symphony if you wanted. But it's sort of like concentrated instead. Well, Webern's going to make, being so terse and small, and Brahms being so rather sprawling by comparison, is going to make a dramatic contrast.
The Brahms Quartets in Context series journeys into the 21st century with the fourth string quartet of Leon Kirchner. Kirchner lived from 1919 to 2009 and ranked among the most distinguished American composers of his generation. His music takes root in the work of such early 20th century luminaries as Bartok, Stravinsky, and Schoenberg, with whom he studied, while also remaining informed by his performances as a pianist and conductor of the classical and romantic repertoire. Against this background, Leon Kirchner established himself early in his career as an heir apparent to the post-romantic European composers, and particularly to the Second Viennese School. But his fierce musical ability and uncompromising artistry ultimately resulted in a distinctly individual compositional voice that, despite its audible roots in Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern, remains unmistakably his own. Aaron Copland once remarked, quote, "The impression carried away from a Kirchner performance is one of having made contact not merely with the composer, but with a highly sentient human being, of a man who creates his music out of an awareness of the special climate of today's unsettled world. Kirchner's pages prove that he reacts strongly to that world. They are charged with an emotional impact and explosive power that is almost frightening in intensity. Whatever else may be said, this is music that is most certainly felt." End quote. Daniel Phillips.
Leon, as a young man, he created a big splash, both as a pianist as composer. Like when he premiered his piano concerto with him playing with Dmitri Mitropoulos in the New York Philharmonic, it created like a big sensation, like another modern day Beethoven or something. And his music has a unique language that no one else has. I mean, you might think it sounds a little bit like early Schoenberg and the like, but it's really so much his own voice. What kind of magic comes out of his hands when he doodles?
Kirchner composed his string quartet number 4 in 2006 for the Orion Quartet.
In effect, actually, the music of the fourth quartet is the last thing Leon Kirchner wrote. We've had a long association with Leon. Before we learned the fourth quartet, we had played the first two often. And I played several things with him and for him. And his music has, as a musician, it appeals to us because it has this deeply expressive authenticity to it. Everything he wrote, he follows his teacher Schoenberg's advice, in which Schoenberg said, "Music has no value unless it arises from the unconscious." So therefore, there's always some kind of deep evocative feeling. Like you would hear, not so much in later Schoenberg, but in the Schoenberg's earlier work or early works of Alban Berg, and this kind of stormy, turbulent kind of feeling. Thank you.
In preparation for the New York premiere of the Fourth Quartet in 2006, I had the opportunity to interview the composer about his quartet cycle. Here's Leon Kirchner.
Each quartet is quite different. This one, I became very interested and eager once more in the Thomas Mann book concerning the 20th century civilization and, in particular, Arnold Schoenberger. In this particular book, Dr. Faustus, the composer, Adrian Leverkund, is a magnificently gifted composer from early age on, and he is eventually visited by the devil, who presents to him the 12-tone, as he calls it, system. And so it seemed to be also a downgrading of what 12-tone stood for. For instance, the devil says that, you know, that we can no longer use a diminished seventh, we can no longer use arpeggios or scales, that the world has passed us by. And it's a kind of symbol of the downfall also of the system, which, again, Schoenberger didn't like that word system. This is not a 12-tone system. 12-tone technique, that's what it is. And to teach it a system is to lessen its impact. But he said on that one day when he discussed something of that nature, he said one can still write a masterpiece in C major if you have the genius to do so. So I decided to do something like that with this fourth quartet, which is to use everything that the devil said can no longer be used. It's historically impossible. And yet my music still sounds like my music with whatever energy it has. And yet I feel that have I become a Philistine? Have I stopped the progress of music? And a lot of music that I've heard is music of trickery and does not have the idea of being beautiful. That book was very fascinating to me. I wrote something that uses dominants and diminished sevenths, but probably never as interestingly as Mozart or Beethoven. And he actually talks about Beethoven in the book. Man said that this was appropriate for Beethoven. He was a master in Opus 111. My music's been swinging toward that area, people tell me. And that I'm no longer in the 20th century, but maybe the 19th.
Later in life, Leon's last decade or so, that being that like the cello concerto and the second piano trio, and some other pieces. He kind of said, you know what, I'm going to write the chords I always loved. I'm going to write my modern composition and just use beautiful chords. I'm not going to try to write dissonances anymore. Not that he'd ever liked them, but like he's returning to his true voice. That's why he named the orchestra version of the Fourth Quartet The Forbidden. It all comes around to like now he really wants to write beautiful chords. So the whole Fourth Quartet, if you slow it down, is nothing but a succession of like exotically beautiful harmonies. There's no actual dissonance in it at all, or no atonality. But it's a kind of jumble that's still his own modern style, and the style that is sort of a intense rhapsodic style that he always wrote in. So his later music sounds like it should be his early pieces, if you listen to them that way. Thank you.
Audio notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wuhan. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following performers and organizations. Johannes Brahms' string quartets, Opus 51, Numbers 1 and 2, and Opus 67, Ludwig van Beethoven's string quartet in C-sharp minor, Opus 131, and Anton Webern's five movements for string quartet, Opus 5, are performed by the Emerson String Quartet and appear with kind permission of Deutsche Grammophon GmbH Hamburg, www.deutschegrammophon.com. Leon Kirchner's String Quartet No. 4 is performed by the Orion String Quartet and appears courtesy of Albany Records. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist-Led.